I think the most important consideration for employers' HR teams, if they're thinking about improving job quality and also business performance, I would focus on training your managers, your line managers, to manage people properly. We know from our Good Work Index and from other research we've carried out that how managers manage and support people on a day-to-day basis is fundamental to their job quality, to their level of engagement, whether they say they're going to go the extra mile for their organisation, whether they say that their work has a positive or negative effect on their mental health, how much stress they're under. All these factors are affected or mitigated by their relationship with their line manager.
Hello and welcome to the Future of Work Hub's In Conversation With podcast. I'm Lucy Lewis, a partner in Lewis Silkin's employment team. And in this podcast series, I'll be hosting exclusive discussions with innovators, business leaders and thought leaders to explore their perspectives on the longer term trends and immediate drivers shaping the world of work. The relationship between employer and employee is changing and the social contract is evolving. People want more from their employer than the old industrial age transactional idea of an employer giving work in return for job security, for fair pay and benefits. There's a growing focus on ethical behaviour, on people's individual needs and on good work. And that means that the traditional employment relationship is looking increasingly outdated. But what's behind people's shift in expectation about work and the role it plays in their lives? And as the focus builds around the need to provide good work, what does that mean for employers and for HR? To help us answer those questions, in this episode, I'm joined by Ben Wilmot. Ben leads the CIPD's public policy team, which works to inform and shape public debate, government policy and legislation to champion better work and better working lives. The CIPD has been driving the good work agenda for a number of years and recently published a manifesto on good work. So Ben is brilliantly placed to share his thoughts on this, but also to help us understand what good work is and why it should matter to employers and their people. So thank you and welcome, Ben. I wondered, just to get us started, to set the context of some of the things I know we'll come on to talk about, I wondered if you could explain briefly from the CIPD's point of view what you mean when you talk about good work.
Well, CIPD has been really measuring good work over the last 7 years or so through what we call our Good Work Index, which is a large-scale survey of employees that tracks job quality and looks at a number of different dimensions of good work. So it looks at things like pay and benefits, people's contractual relationship, are they permanent, are they part-time, or are they on a 0 hours arrangement, for example. Things like work-life balance, job design, relationships in the workplace, so relationships that people have with their manager or their colleagues, employee voice, and health and well-being, including people's mental health and well-being, and things like stress. So those elements of job quality provides sort of trend data in terms of how those dimensions are developing, whether people are perceiving that changes across those areas are becoming more positive or negative. And so it gives us a really good understanding of how good work or job quality is evolving in the UK context.
Thanks, Ben. We'll definitely come back to talk about some of those topics. They're really interesting. There's been a lot of discussion about the concept of good work. You may or may not know that my fellow partner James Davis wrote a report last year where he talks about the term prefab jobs in the context of good work. And that is people wanting purpose, fair and transparent reward, engagement, flexibility, autonomy, and a sense of belonging. What do you think is driving this good work agenda, and why do you think it's becoming so important in the workplace?
I think there's a number of drivers. Certainly a really topical one at the moment is we've seen rising levels of economic inactivity since the pandemic, which is of real concern to policymakers. So we're seeing an increasing proportion of people who are falling out of employment due to ill health. So that is really, again, focusing on the importance of the creation of more flexible and healthy jobs that can support labour market participation, that can help keep people healthy and in work, and also then provide sort of more flexible jobs that can help people come back into employment. So that's certainly a key driver within the current context. But there are other areas. Obviously, another big area is around the rapid developments in technology, particularly in AI, which is really getting policymakers and businesses to think about how can organisations adopt technology in a way that is optimal for both the business, but also for workers, that doesn't unnecessarily degrade job quality, that can actually hopefully augment job quality in many instances. So really, within that, the role of HR is really important.
That's fascinating. Again, we'll come back to some of those issues. In particular, I'd love to talk to you about the productivity puzzle and the associated policy issues, because I know that's been a really big part of your job. But before we get to that, there's just a couple of things it would be helpful to pick up on. One of those is you talked about job design, and that's one of those terms we hear used quite a lot. You know, plenty of people listening to this podcast will be HR professionals. They'll be familiar with the concept of job design. But for those that aren't, it'd be really helpful if you could talk about what you mean when you talk about job design, and then perhaps a little bit about how employers can go about starting to incorporate some of these principles of good work into their job design projects.
Sure. Well, I suppose at a top line level, job design is the process of establishing employees' roles and responsibilities. So setting out the tasks in the job and how an employee completes the tasks. And so job design will look at things like the purpose of the job, you know, how that relates to the organizational purpose. Look at things like health and safety, of course, make sure that the tasks and the pace of work is not going to undermine people's health and safety, for example. Looks at things like productivity. So is the job focusing on the things that matter? And then also, you know, hopefully will also include a focus on job quality. So things like flexibility, how much autonomy people have in the role, what sort of breadth and challenge there is. And so collectively brings those elements together to try and create a job that is both high quality, but one that also supports business performance and productivity.
Thanks, Ben. That's really interesting, particularly when we look at some of the ways that jobs, as you say, are evolving through technology, and particularly the acceleration of technology, and the need to be reflecting these things when we're looking at roles now. Before we come back to policy, which I definitely want to get to, there are a couple of tensions that I think we see employers facing when they come to look at this broader concept of good work. And one of those goes to work-life balance and goes to flexibility, which we were just talking about. Because we obviously all know that since the COVID pandemic, we've been a lot more flexible. And we see, you know, significantly greater number of people with remote working arrangements. But more recently, and probably in the last 6 months or so, one of the things that we are seeing is a shift in employers wanting to mandate some sort of office return, and not necessarily by any means a full office return, but just wanting to be more directional about employees coming into the office. Do you think there's an inherent tension there, or can you still embrace this idea of flexibility whilst having a degree of mandating office attendance?
I don't think there's necessarily a one-size-fits-all approach to this. I think it's really about employers trying to find that sweet spot where the flexibility works for both employees and the business. And that balance will be established very much employer to employer, workplace to workplace. So I think that's the sort of the key thing, that I think employers shouldn't lose sight of the benefits that flexible working can deliver in terms of recruiting and retaining a more diverse workplace. So I think it's trying to really find that sweet spot. I think that's the important thing. The other thing that businesses really need to think about when they're thinking about flexibility is trying to ensure that it's not just those who can work from home or those who work in a hybrid way can benefit. So we know there's a real unmet demand for flexible hours arrangements, things like term time working or job share or annualized hours or compressed hours. We know that there's, from our research, there's a real unmet demand amongst employees for those type of flexible working arrangements, which can benefit people who have to be physically present in the workplace. So I think that's another really important dimension, is to try and find flexible working options that can benefit the whole workforce and not just those who can work from home.
Thanks, Ben. That's really sensible and practical advice. And it's good, I think, in any capacity to be focusing on why you need people into the office. What is the reason that you need them? That's also the advice we're giving when we look at legal risks. And really helpful as well that you picked up on those people that it's not so easy for them to work from home and what flexibility means for those people. Because I think one of the tensions that we see is employers are concerned when they're implementing a strategy, particularly around flexibility, that there might be an idea or challenge around fairness. And your comments about that, you know, what's fair in one role might not be fair in another, doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have a sensible, good work strategy, focus on some of the key things that you've talked about, you know, particularly flexibility, autonomy. So really great that you touched on that, because I think that is an area of tension when people are thinking about what a return to the office should look like. We're going to come to the policy questions, because that's obviously a really big issue and it's an interesting year. But there's a couple of things to pick up on. If we start with a more general question before we get to the idea of an election year, one of the things I think is challenging but really interesting in this area is where the balance should lie between employers and the competitive advantage that comes from doing, you know, all the good work piece and government legislation, you know, the kind of carrot and stick approach. Do you have a view on where the balance should be between employers and then the government and legislation?
I think it's very much a sort of shared agenda. And I think, you know, what we know, I suppose, from looking at indicators like sort of the OECD indicators around employment protection, is that overall the UK is fairly lightly regulated when it comes to employment regulation and, for example, the protections that individual workers have. But we also have, you know, relatively high levels of employment, and we have a relatively low proportion of people in secure work by international standards. So understanding the top line impact of employment relations framework is important. However, it doesn't mean that they're not real challenges around people who are treated unfairly, face discrimination. And we know that there's a real problem with labour market enforcement system, both individual route through the tribunals and through our enforcement bodies, which are significantly under-resourced. So there is a real challenge for individuals, if they are treated unfairly, if they are being discriminated against, to actually find access to justice and route to compensation. We need a functioning labour market enforcement system. If we're going to have a floor, a functioning floor for employment rights and a level playing field to ensure that employers can't, you know, undermine good employers by breaching these standards. So it's a really important area. And I think that's an area that you would hope that an incoming government would really look to fix. And that means a enforcement system that's also more progressive, which has a stronger role for ACAS to help particularly SMEs improve their people management development capability, because we know that there's a real difficulty there. They lack the time and resources and the knowledge often to meet their legal responsibilities. So we think that there's a real case for a stronger role for ACAS to support that push to improve overall employment standards.
Thanks, Ben. I know the other thing the CIPD have talked about from a policy perspective, and it'd be great if you could say something about this, is the skills agenda and the extent to which that is a policy or government issue. You know, it obviously needs to be one that is done in partnership with employers, but to the extent to which there needs to be a policy imperative around skills.
I think what we have seen over the last 20 years is a decline in employer investment in skills development and training, which is without doubt, you know, linked to our stagnating productivity levels. So, you know, I think there is a real need for a change in policy in key areas. For example, the apprenticeship levy, which since it was introduced in 2017, we've seen collapse in apprenticeships being created amongst SMEs. And we've also seen a significant decline in apprenticeships going to young people. So we think if there was a more flexible skills or training levy, that could help free up more funding for apprenticeships to go to young people and to address genuine technical skills shortages, and also to be used more flexibly to upskill existing employees through other forms of accredited training and development.
Thanks, Ben. The last aspect that the CIPD talks about in relation to this is one that you talked about right at the outset, and I think it's really interesting. That's the idea of healthy work. You know, given that there are a bigger number of people than ever before not in work for health-related reasons, that also feels like a policy issue as well as an employer issue. Are there policy things that we should expect to see people calling for as we come into election year in relation to making work more healthy for people and keeping people in work?
I think we need much more ambition around public policy to support healthier work and workplaces. So, you know, we certainly need greater investment in occupational health support for small firms. One thing that CIPD has been involved in the last few years is running a number of HR support pilots to small firms in different parts of the UK. And that has shown there is real value in providing a limited amount of pump priming HR consultancy support to small firms to help them build their sort of core basic HR and people management capability, and that this was associated with improvements in workplace relations and labour productivity. And we know key areas of HR practice, such as, you know, reasonable adjustments, flexible working, making sure that people can make phased return to work, those areas are really important to keeping people healthy and in work and preventing people from falling out of employment. So we think that there is a real opportunity to look at, you know, what type of business support is available, and also crucially making sure that there is better access and better signposting to occupational health support, for particularly for SMEs.
You know, of course, for all policy change, particularly support for businesses, there's a cost that, you know, in an election year, no doubt, is going to be under a lot of scrutiny. Presumably the CIPD response is that without addressing these things and without actually investing that cost, we are just not going to address the productivity puzzle. We won't improve productivity in the UK for all of the reasons that you've said, unless we're willing to invest. And in other words, this is a sort of package of policy measures that has a cost associated with them. But if we don't spend that money, we won't achieve the kind of productivity that we aspire to in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I didn't mention, Lucy, was, you know, the other area of policy really important around health and wellbeing would be, you know, statutory sick pay reform. We know that the level of statutory sick pay is very low in the UK by international standards, and it's also very inflexible. So we need to make statutory sick pay more flexible so people can be paid statutory sick pay in a flexible way, for example, if they are coming back to work in a phased way. But we absolutely need to increase the rate of the level of statutory sick pay. And that probably is going to be, that's an area we absolutely need an in-depth consultation to work out how that's going to be paid for, who's going to be, is that going to be shared between government and businesses? But I think that point around some of these policies, like a more effective and progressive labour market enforcement system, better access to occupational health, a reformed statutory sick pay, you know, that will cost money. And I think part of this is really thinking these policies need to be seen as part of an industrial strategy that is seeking to improve overall employment standards across the economy to support improvements in productivity and labour market participation. But I think also there are areas of spending that maybe, you know, the next government could look at. So, for example, in R&D tax incentives, we invest, you know, rightly a lot of public funding in R&D incentives. But I think there is a case to potentially reallocate what would be a relatively small proportion of the R&D tax incentive budget to support some policies that would boost innovation adoption. So the adoption of better quality management, the adoption of technology, the adoption, you know, investment in skills. We know that together, you know, these elements are fundamental to efforts to improve productivity. But at the moment, there's not many policy mechanisms to actually incentivize, encourage and enable, you know, more businesses to invest more in those areas, which are real areas of weakness in terms of business investment currently.
Thanks, Ben. Really interesting ideas, and particularly thinking through how things are paid for. Clearly, there's a critical piece in solving this productivity puzzle. I'm going to take you back to our HR audience. And one of the things I think when you listen to these podcasts is you come away really inspired about the value of changing. And I know there are lots of organisations, lots of charters, alliances out there. You know, for example, the CIPD is working with Greater Manchester Good Employment Charter. There's the World Economic Forum Institute of Future of Work also have charters and alliances. And those things are focused on trying to get people to take some action now. So if you're listening to this and you think, you know, I'm really committed to embedding this idea of good work into the way that we do things, what would be your three or four tips that would give you a great place to start, things to look at, to go away and to think about having heard this?
I think the most important consideration for employers, HR teams, if they're thinking about improving job quality and also business performance, I would focus on training your managers, your line managers, to manage people properly. We know from our Good Work Index and from other research we've carried out that how managers manage and support people on a day-to-day basis is fundamental to their job quality, to their level of engagement, whether they say they're going to go the extra mile for their organisation, whether they say that their work has a positive or negative effect on their mental health, you know, how much stress they're under. All these factors are affected or mitigated by their relationship with their line manager. And we know that core soft people, so-called soft people management skills, the ability of managers to manage their emotions, not pass stress on, to proactively manage problems like conflict at an early stage, you know, use their judgment to try and deal with things informally where they can, but, you know, use the formal processes when they need to. Things like constructive feedback and real clear clarity of communication over people's objectives. And critically, managers who know their people, who demonstrate they care about them, who know the thing that matter to them and provide flexibility and support. Those elements are critical to creating trust in the employment relationship. I think without trust, then it's very difficult to develop a productive work culture and sustainable work culture where people will, you know, want to stay with you as an employer and be resilient under pressure.
Thanks, Ben. I'm going to end by asking you the question I'm asking all our podcast guests in this 2024 podcast series. And it may be you've already answered that question, but considering everything we've discussed, what do you think are the two priority action points for employers and their HR teams in trying to build organizational resilience? Maybe the answer to that is effective training, in which case that's totally fine.
I think it is, yeah. Equip your line managers to manage people properly. I think the other thing is really be able to build the business case for investment in people management. So really highlighting the data that will influence senior leadership teams and boards, why investment in HR and people management and development is critical to the delivery of business strategy. Because I think that's an area where if we're going to see, you know, greater investment in skills to support workplace productivity, it's those discussions at board level and within senior leadership team that need to be informed by real understanding of the value of the workforce.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ben. It's been really interesting, particularly the discussion around some of those policy things and things that we can expect to see in what is likely to be an election year. It's been a fascinating discussion. I'm sure everybody listening will feel the same. If you're listening and you'd like to know more about some of the things Ben's been talking about, or more generally about the CIPD's work, its manifesto, or their Good Work Index, you can visit their website, www.cipd.org. Thank you, Ben.